Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you enjoy what we do, please like, comment, and share in your favorite podcast app. And we'll keep sharing great conversations like the one we have today. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. One of the most obvious ways AI is used to help humans is by making it easier to find and process information. First, there was the Yahoo directory going back many years. Then there was Google keyword search. And when I got into enterprise search in the early 2000s, Google-like information retrieval was available for enterprises from vendors like InfoSeek, Inc2Me, and Verity. They were some of the early ones. Even the best keyword search systems today suffer from two problems. The first is you need to know which keywords are in the documents you want. And then second, there's not really any intelligence applied to documents retrieved. So typically you get back kind of lists of links. The subfield of AI that we've talked about a little bit on this show is called NLP, or natural language processing. And it makes it possible to ask for what you need using plain English, or of course the language of your choice. And you get back answers rather than links. It's kind of a linguistic understanding or a semantic understanding by the AI. It's a classic example of where AI is augmenting humans, certainly not replacing them. Today, we get to speak with an expert in applying NLP to the field of medical research. We'll learn how this approach makes it possible for medical experts to get value out of kind of esoteric journals and other unstructured data sources that contain most of what's actually needed to advance their fields. DDoS started Sourcero in April 2018 to make technical content more accessible to experts in STEM fields. Since then, the company's raised about $16 million from leading VCs and built an amazing team of technologists. Before starting the company, D founded 42 Strategies to help social impact organizations with digital transformation initiatives. D has also been active in organizations helping women advance their careers in leadership roles, a topic that listeners know I'm passionate about. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome D to the podcast. D, let's get started by having you share maybe a little bit more about your background and how you got into the space.
Sure. First and foremost, thank you, Dan, for having me on your podcast. I am honored and I am always excited to tell the story of what we're building out at Sourcero and, more important, why. My name is Dipanita Das. I go by D. I'm the CEO and one of the three co-founders of Sourcero. My background is at the intersection of public policy and technology. For many, many years, I have worked on large-scale data collection and analysis platforms to help adults in the workspace keep up with their field, take better and more effective decisions at scale, and ultimately be able to communicate what they need to communicate in order to move the field itself forward. And a great example of this is, of course, being able to communicate effectively some of the bad effects of tobacco in order to move legislation forward. That brought me to have a very, very, very deep understanding of the difficulties of communicating science at scale, and a much deeper appreciation of what our customers and users and colleagues in life sciences are trying to do: make better, more nuanced decisions based on vast amounts of complex medical and scientific content, make it faster, and make sure that everybody who that information impacts, patients and physicians and insurers, are able to access that in a timely manner.
Talk to us about the founding vision for Sourcero. You've done so many interesting things in your career. You went down the rabbit hole here.
I did indeed. And what I've been reflecting a lot on what I've done before and how I came to it. It's a question I'm asked often, and I like to boil it down to really three things. First and foremost, I am deeply, deeply passionate about building systems. Infrastructure, whether you talk about an organizational infrastructure or technical infrastructure, really gets me excited because infrastructure allows you to build things on it. And as a single person or a single company, you cannot solve all of the problems that need to be solved. But if you're able to build consistent, standardized infrastructure, other people can build on top of it and start solving their problems. And that's one thing that has led me over and over again, both back to entrepreneurship, but even more so back to platforms. Number two, doing something that leads the legacy of good. Building a company, building a product, it's a lot of hard work. And a lot of people, and just, you know, Sorcero's team for one, is putting in an incredible amount of love and care and dedication into building something great. I want to make sure that we can be proud of it and make sure that it is moving the needle forward for us in improving patient outcomes through better decision-making. And third is, are we supporting something that can truly scale? One of the things that's extremely exciting about public policy, as dry as it sometimes may sound, is the scale of its impact. And so for me, I want to make sure that what I'm doing can scale in the right hands and with the right kind of focus and planning. So these are the three things that really tie everything I've done in the past and what we're trying to do with Sorcero. And come April 2018, when I was at dinner with one of our co-founders, Walter Bender, what really got us excited was the potential of A, that the market needed a platform, it needed infrastructure that was fit to purpose for medical and scientific content, that the regulations and the push to have more evidence-based medicine meant that the market needed to buy and adopt and scale these tools. So it's opportunistic, of course. And then number three was the technology itself. You refer to NLP. We call it language intelligence. We marry heuristic AI, statistical AI, and linguistics all together. And transfer learning models, amongst other things that came out in 2018 in a big way, enables us to do that.
I love that you talk specifically about wanting to do work that matters. Going back to the founding of the company, 2018, talk to us about either a doctor, a researcher, a user that you're most proud of, and how do they use the platform?
Sure. So I'll take a step back and talk about the problem we solve and then how we solve it. So our users are usually MD PhDs at pharma companies. They fall under medical and scientific affairs, which is the fast emerging third pillar within the scientific and life sciences community, who are tasked with advancing scientific engagement itself. It's very interesting, but their work and the impact of their work is in whether the therapeutic area that they're focused on or the target patient population they're focused on, are they being better treated through an appropriate application of their products and therapies? That's really what they're trying to measure. So they are measuring scientific impact. So A, it's extremely exciting. Number two, they're dealing with both internal and external data. And these are some of the data types we deal with. For example, clinical literature at scale, not just what's publicly available, but also full text articles that are coming from all sorts of spaces. Healthcare data is growing at a 36% CAGR. And I'm going to leave it there for a moment to understand that this data needs to be analyzed. It's not a choice. It's not a nice to have. So our users are dealing with a deluge of external data as well as internal data. It could be coming from insights, it could be coming from CRMs, it could be coming from their field medical teams. And they have to bring this all together in a complex, heterogeneous space and then say, hey, HCP treating cancer patient, you should consider this therapy and not the other one because their biomarkers show us that therapy one will work better than therapy two. In the end, that's what matters. And I'll give you a personal story, actually, rather than one of our customers to really, really bring this home. One of my colleagues, one of their parents has recently been diagnosed with, metastatic breast cancer. And it's a tough, tough diagnosis to deal with. And they were prescribed a course of treatment. Now, our analysis using our software showed that that was actually maybe not the best treatment for them, but their alternative was much more expensive in the short term and cheaper in the long term. This kind of economic data is called health economics and outcome research data. Very interesting, but in clinical literature. So we were able to use our platform to give them the information they needed to make a case to their care team to change their treatment. And they were able to do that, because the data that people can extract from our platform's analysis allows them to make the kind of economics-based case for a differential treatment. That's why Sorcero exists, is to enable this transformation in somebody's life coming off of an extremely distressing diagnosis.
I love that you keep coming back to better patient outcomes. And so if I'm understanding the problem space correctly, the pre-Sorcero example would be potentially using limited information to draw potentially incorrect or incomplete conclusions about things like how to treat a cancer patient. Is that over-dramatizing the impact of?
No, actually not. There are some very, very interesting numbers, but as even the best-in-class physician is in no place to keep up with the rapid evolution of science. And they are more and more relying on the creators of therapies to tell them both how to treat a particular kind of patient better, how to use their therapies better. So that one is just the quality. The other part is the timeliness of it. How fast is the latest research getting into the hands of practitioners? How fast is it going from access to information or access to knowledge to the usability of knowledge? So with Sorcero, we aim to solve for both. One is not just you can access it, but really more important, can I use it now? Do I understand why it matters? Do I understand why this particular change in a therapy really matters for the kind of patients I treat? That's the part that is really important. It's quality and timeliness.
So you referenced the 36% CAGR, cumulative annual growth rate, and data. Clearly, it's not a problem that is at human scale in terms of being able to process 36% more information year over year.
Not at all.
So it makes sense. Good, obviously good fit for technology and for AI. Talk us through how you turn the data into insights. A little bit more about the technology.
Sure. So our platform has essentially three broad pieces to it. First and foremost is our ingestion framework, which allows us to bring in content that is from any format from any source. So we're format and source agnostic, ingestion framework straight through into a data lake. This is important because ingestion isn't an act of extraction. It doesn't destroy the document if the document is what we're ingesting from. It retains all of that richness. Once it's in the knowledge fabric, we can then begin to enrich it. Usually we use a marriage of different kinds of deep learning and language models, as well as ontologies to bring in that accuracy. And then that heterogeneous data pool is the basis of our analysis. So then that brings us to the third part of the platform. So you've got your ingestion, you've got your enrichment and applying either the model academy or the ontologies to get that data into something usable. And then our third block is how do people use this data? So on the business user side, they use it in one of three ways. They use it for situational awareness, competitive intelligence, really seeing how the field that they're working on moves forward. And that falls under the bucket of sort of our monitoring. The third is what we are actually launching a new product next week. I'm just going to tease this here. I'm not going to give too much information. I don't want to take away from it, but our application gives our users for the very first time a view of the full product lifecycle and the total impact of their scientific engagement end to end, which has just never been done before. So our users are now able to see, am I succeeding in moving the needle forward? How am I succeeding? How is it working? What are the messages that are working better? That kind of analysis. And then the third is pharmacovigilance. Is my product performing as it should? And this is both responding to new regulations, but it's also that the burden of monitoring has gone up radically, where the authorities are demanding much more real-time and at-scale monitoring of clinical literature that has just never been done before. So that's what the system does. So it allows our users 10x more productivity. It reduces monitoring time by the human by 92%. And also performs at a 96.1% net positive. So basically the accuracy is best in class. So our users are able to make more nuanced decisions. And that's really what I want to talk about here for a moment. It isn't about automating, because automating can only be done for very simplistic tasks. For what our people do, Our users are MD-PhDs. It's helping them make better, more nuanced decisions at scale and speed in keeping with the regulatory needs of the markets they serve.
So solving the problem of ingestion makes sense. That's fairly well documented how you do that. Enrichment is a more interesting challenge. Particularly when we're talking about unstructured data, you know, for anyone who's been around NLP knows that that's the hard thing. And the more you understand the domain, the more valuable your enrichment is. Talk us through, you mentioned using ontologies and some of the other lexical techniques that you use. Talk us through more about how you apply, call it structure, to an unstructured document using domain awareness.
Sure. One of my favorite topics. And again, I will stop where I think I'm treading too much into pure AI land. But the way to think about how Sorcera represents domain and then finally the user is in five layers. It's a pyramid. Start at the bottom, where we first identify the language. And in this case, the way we look at languages, is it English? Is it not English to begin with? Next, it, what is the domain? And that is, in this case, is it oncology or dermatology? Next, what is the subdomain? Oncology isn't good enough. There is nothing called medical ontology or oncology ontology. What kind of oncology are you looking for? Down to as precise as possible. Next is context of that user itself. For example, am I looking for symptoms? Am I looking for dosage? Am I looking for, what am I looking for in this bucket of data? Or am I looking for all of the above and the interplay between? So it's purely looking at concepts, not just at words. And that's really important. And that's, there's a lot of disambiguation that has to happen there. So, you know, misspelt word, a misspelt term. And then last, but certainly not the least, is you represent the company, the customer, through their taxonomies, through their glossaries, through their proprietary language or whatever they may have created. In some cases, our customers have already been working on ontology, so we bring that in. These five layers are applied one after the other, truly in a hierarchical method, and that actually is one of our patents in this space, allows us to bring accuracy, not just at scale, but much more important in a small data corpora. For our market, it's not the massive that matters. It's accuracy and precision in just the right place. And that's probably been the trickiest part of what we do, is how do you bring an anti-fragile AI-powered system into small, you know, working with small data corpora.
We talk a lot in this program about what it means to practice responsible AI. And I tend to kind of casually use three parameters. AI that's responsible is transparent. So I know when an automated decision is being made. It's predictable. The same inputs will reliably generate the same outputs, and it's configurable. If the automated decision is deemed to be incorrect, there's no black box. There's a set of levers to turn to bring it back into line with expectations. And the kind of related question that I'm always interested to get answered from guests is to kind of assess the level, call it the level of responsibility of the AI. What if something goes wrong? What are the implications if a Sorcera model is performing poorly? And you know, I guess the follow up to that is, and how do you monitor for the accuracy of the model's output?
Great question. So again, I'll take a step back because I've been again talking about AI ethics and biases and all of these things quite a bit. The first and foremost, I want to make the point that a lot of the issues we have with bias comes from the raw data itself and not knowing what is encoded in that data. So anything you build on top of it is inherently broken. It's garbage in, garbage out. So certainly the attempts we make to identify that bias from the outset in whatever way we can as AI practitioners is really essential. So I would almost call it an ontology of bias. So if you're dealing with life sciences or clinical information, what are the commonly known biases that may appear in this content? And those biases are commonly known. There may be other things, but we have a place to start. So the first part of responsible AI is having some way of identifying the bias within the data that you're working on. That's one. Number two, one of the core parts of our system is what we call a validation workflow. It's not supervised learning. It is exactly what, describing what you talked about. Our users are subject matter experts, and they can tell when they look at a work screen whether something is on or off. So we have two layers of SMEs. We have SMEs within the company who are of the same expertise as our users and who do that check on a regular basis. So we have computer monitoring, human monitoring. Of course, there's transparency and auditability. And then we also have the users monitoring. So we've got sort of lots of layers to make sure that information isn't wrong. Number one. Number two, we have stayed away from the point of care and the kind of black box system that can come sometimes when you're saying making a recommendation that will immediately touch the patient. We believe that the role of a subject matter expert is essential because only they can tell if something is wrong with a recommendation or a piece of analysis on clinical literature. No patient can tell that something is wrong. So those are choices we have made. So three important things. One is identifying the bias in the core data. Number two is making sure there's a validation loop. And then number three is staying away as much as possible from the end recipient of that decision and putting subject matter experts in every step. So these are the three things that we have done to make sure that we're responsible.
So here's a harder one I'd love to get your perspective on. What responsibilities does Sercero have if you're surfacing content that maybe is of questionable integrity? So it's one thing to provide the rigor that you just described to the process of, you know, how you enrich it, you know, how you retrieve it, that sort of thing. But do you ever think about the responsibility that you have for the, you know, the you know, has it been, you know, let's see, peer reviewed or kind of the integrity of the underlying content? I could imagine that, there could be a set of ethical issues. It would be indirectly your obligation, but nonetheless, you've provided that content to the expert. How do you think about that second level ethical challenge?
So the great part of what we do is our experts tell us what sources of content they care about. And our users are using peer-reviewed. They don't take into account what is not peer-reviewed. So within their ecosystem, the literature, the content that's coming out is that's from the external world is peer reviewed, or it is something like social media where they're trying to figure out what's being talked about. So it's not informing a medical decision. It may be informing a business decision. So when it comes to what kind of content we deal with, Sercero does not work in a space where content that we are analyzing doesn't have a supervision layer built in already. So whether it's Congress intelligence, it's, you know, literature from PubMed, if it's preprint, we know what the source is. And we actually have the source linked right back in our system. So anytime you enter the system, you can go back to where everything came from. It's there. So one is just a software linkage, but the other is the choice of content. And differentiating between when it's a business decision. So I'm looking at an insight from a conversation between a physician and a field team member about a product or a drug. We know what the context of that is, which means we know how to mediate. So that's how we stay away from that kind of liability. It's not the same for our space.
So you're developing these expert systems, and one of the concerns that immediately comes up in the medical community when we have these kinds of conversations about the incursion of AI into their specialized domain is, at what point could a patient go directly to Sercero and bypass the medical professional? Will we ever automate away the need for the professional?
Absolutely not. And I cannot be more emphatic about that. It's a core part of Sercero. There's a symbolic formula we use in everything, which says humans plus AI is greater than either alone. Medicine, which is an ever-changing space, is hard enough for a human being with 20 years of school to keep up with. On the other hand, many of the AI-powered systems in the world today struggles to differentiate between elbow and elbow. So I certainly do not believe that in the very near term, we will anytime be replacing the physician, but much more important, I don't think that's the right goal. I just think that's the wrong goal for us to strive towards. I much rather have a physician that is armed with the great latest and the greatest and able to bring the best of their expertise to bear at every time they treat a patient. It does not in any way excite me to think that we're automating the doctor away. That's not the right goal.
So Dee, you're telling me you're not signing up to do your own appendectomy anytime soon, huh?
Dear God, no. I barely want to put, you know, trim my own nails, much less do my own appendectomy.
I love it. So polish your crystal ball 10 years from now. And you've paved the planet with Sorcero, and it's the Kleenex, you know, of tools for the medical community. How's my life different as a patient?
I hope, and I am actually pretty certain, that if we are truly able to touch every medical affairs professional in the world today who's interacting with healthcare providers on any sort of, you know, on a continuous basis, that your doctor is better prepared. That's the real thing to measure is your doctor better prepared? Is your first diagnosis more correct than sometimes the first diagnosis tends to be? Are you getting the right medication straight out the gate? Are you being given the right dosage? And are you being treated without bias? So if we're able to identify the biases that may be ingrained in core, the base literature, are you being treated without bias? Those are the things that are really, really important. And we should be able to measure that simply from the same dashboards that our customers are using. If they're able to move their science forward, we're going to see it in the literature and we'll know that we've made that impact.
I mentioned in the opener that one of the things I liked about your background is that you've spent a lot of time working on projects that have social impact and specifically looking at females having access to STEM careers. I'm going to have my two daughters who are 12 and 14 listen to this. And I want you to tell them, why should they feel like they're entering a world of work that provides equal access to females?
I am both the daughter and a granddaughter of two women scientists. Geophysicist. My grandmother was a geophysicist and a mathematician and one of the best in India at her time. And she would have been 100 this year, just to give you a sense of her time or her age. And my mother, who is a solid state physicist. The only way to win is to persist. And that's the best piece of advice I ever got from them is do not allow perceived or real hurt, insult, sexism, whatever it is, to ever push you out. Because if you persist, you're there. And at the end of the day, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So the only way I think women in STEM and women at work are going to make sure they have their space at that table is to be immovable. It's not a world. It's a rough world out there. But the thing about women is that they are far more resilient and able to take a lot more and keep moving forward. So that's what you should index on. So to your daughters, persist.
Have you ever felt in your career disadvantaged because of your gender?
Oh, yeah. Like a million times, in so many ways. So, you know, when growing up a girl, the boys are out there, the girls are at home having to be protected and safe. It's from being kept away from extracurricular activities. Mind you, I grew up in Calcutta and went to college in Delhi, a very different environment than the one I inhabit today. But nonetheless, you know, I grew up in a world where women's safety is a critical problem, and women's safety being such a problem keep women and girls away from work and school and extracurriculars because they want to be safe. So that's one. Number two is just society that tends to be more patriarchal. Oh, you know, you're going to get married, right? So there's that. again, I mentioned my privilege of being a daughter of Nahum and daughter and a granddaughter, which means I certainly had a much more supportive family. But that's one. Today, when I go to raise money, today, when I go and hire people, there is a little bit of gender, a little bit of youth. Both of those things can come and play against you. But at the end of the day, you have to persist. And, you know, it is statistically proven that women run companies of a 35% better ROI on investment than men. So at the end of the day, the data will tell. It's not going to be easy, but the data will tell.
What do you do if you're a female and you encounter implicit bias? It's so easy just to turn around and pursue a field that you're expected to pursue. But I love the term persist, but make it real. What does that mean when you actually encounter implicit, let alone explicit, but implicit bias?
I'm trying to think of a good example because I can think of so many. Well, let me put it in a language that we all understand. So Sorcero is venture funded. Once a year, every year, without exception, I have to go raise a round of capital. That means that I'm talking to potentially hundreds of people. And these are some of the comments that I have heard. I want to invest in this company. This is in a great market. I wasn't expecting to find something like this. But I'm afraid that you won't be able to lead this into scale. Not something that I think you would hear very often. Number two. So how do you think you're going to work with all of these men around you? Do you think they're going to listen to you? So again, these are comments that I have not only been made to me, they've been made to many other incredible female, not just founders, but CEOs of companies when they go out and raise money. And when you encounter it, you say what you will say, always with grace, and then just put them on a blacklist. That's it. Because at the end of the day, there are many, many incredible people out there, women and men, who will support you as a woman. I would say index on that and start to just ignore and leave behind the people who are still struggling with the concept of gender equity.
Unbelievable. Just unbelievable, those examples. In 2022, and I know that I wanted you to share those examples because unfortunately I know they're real. And I know that the point of finger here, I know the venture capital industry is perfectly designed to perpetuate itself. And it's it's clearly, to your point, a very patriarchal culture, but it takes strong women leaders like you to demonstrate why that amazing metric that you cited, why that's real.
And so we have some incredible female venture capitalists, not just backing Sorcero, but just in the community. And one of the things I'm excited about is to see that change as well, in not just the VC community, but the community in which we work itself and the community of startups and technology, where women are often left behind, not because they're not good enough, but for very many other reasons. So women in tech, women in AI, women in life sciences, women. And so as long as there are strong women who are immovable, really immovable, we'll be fine.
Persist. You said it best.
Persist.
I hope a lot of women and girls out there are listening to you, and we should all be rooting for you to succeed because it's a great story. I love your energy. I love the problem that you're solving. It's not just about doing work that matters, but you built an amazing team and it's a problem that needs to be solved, and you really deserve to be very successful solving it. So thanks for coming on the show and hanging out. This is really fun.
Thank you, Dan. Again, it was my pleasure. And you are right. Sorcero has an incredible team, and I'm honored to work with them on our chosen problem every day.
Dee, before I let you go, where can the audience learn more about you and the work that you're doing at Sorcero?
So sorcero.com, Sorcero, think of magic and us in the same thought. follow us on LinkedIn. We have some great, great posts and blogs and webinars coming up, and that'll be great. And then you could always reach out to us at info@sorcero.com if you want to chat with any of us on the team. And I hope you will reach out.
Good stuff. Dee, before we close, I was reminded when you were sharing your last set of remarks about one of my favorite quotes from Malala. I'm sure you've heard it, but I'll share it with the audience. I raise my voice not so that I can shout, but so that those without a voice can be heard. We can't all succeed when half of us are held back. That's always inspired me. It's something I've shared with my kids in the past, but you're the embodiment of what Malala was talking about.
Wow. I'm really flattered, and I only hope that I'm able to demonstrate that kind of bravery. But she is brave, and I hope many of us have the strength in ourselves to be as brave when called upon.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, we're all rooting for you. Thanks for coming and hanging out, and best of luck to you and the team.
Thank you, Dan. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Well, this is your host, Dan Turchin of AI and the Future of Work, signing off for this week, but we're back next week with another fascinating guest.